please dial star 611 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about Hacker Spaces. This here little radio program about Hacker Spaces.
Howdy, this is GMC.
And this is Kyle.
And we're in the United States, which is not so much of a surprise for Kyle, but myself, haven't been here before. So,
that's right, you haven't been here.
I haven't been here. This is my first time in the States.
Well, welcome to the United States.
Well, thank you, Kyle. So, I just arrived. Been here now for a few days. And what all did we do?
Well, you flew in and took the train, I guess.
What did you? So that was a long flight. It's beautiful, though. I mean,
Where did you enter the country?
I sat down in Chicago, actually.
Oh, good. And what was that like?
Well, I got out there, and then I couldn't use my phone because then I would be arrested, they told me. But I had the expectations that it would be really bad, and I was prepared for anal visitations and all that. But in the end, it wasn't that bad, actually. I mean, I went up to customs, and, well, they asked me a few questions. It was a bit difficult to explain that you are going to the States to travel around the country in 6 weeks and visit hackerspaces and stay with people you've never met. I mean, that's the kind of questions they ask, right? Where are you staying? How are you paying for it? And what kind of job do you have? And are you in? So I told them I was in IT and everything. How did you meet your friend Kyle? That kind of questions. And
So you told them about me.
Well, they wanted to know where I was heading, you know, the address and all. You have to fill out the form actually, or on the website. It's the ESTA thing. You fill in all these details. Where are you going to stay? Are you a criminal? Are you a Nazi?
Right,
are you going to bring any drugs in?
Right.
So the smart thing is to answer no to all these questions. Yeah. And well, if you have a decent story, and if you speak the truth, then you're likely to be let in, I think.
See, and this is a little bit different than I think your impression was before before actually experiencing it.
It is.
You were a little, like, you know, apprehensive, kind of anxious about the idea of entering the country. I think there's a lot of horror stories about the laws and the restrictions in the U.S.
Well, not only horror stories. If you read the documentation, if you prepare for your trip, you read the document. There's a lot of scary stuff in there.
Yeah, and I was just going to add that it's not so much that they're stories. They're, you know, I mean, they're real realities. You know, it's not all, you know, exaggerations. A lot of it is pretty serious.
True, and stuff happens sometimes. But yeah, maybe I was just lucky. Maybe it's. But I got out of that quite smooth. It was a long line, but that was the most annoying part of it. Well, I had to give them my fingerprints, of course, which I already had to give when I got my passport. But it's a price I have to pay to visit the States. I wish they didn't do it, but it's not something I wouldn't. You know, it didn't stop me from going here. But then I got on a domestic flight, and that was odd because security there was even more strict than for getting into the country.
Oh, wow.
That's weird, right? I mean, if you're from Yemen or I don't know where, and you're going to blow up something, you come into the country first, and then. So that was a bit surprising. But then I got in there and arrived in Seattle, and it's funny, they have all these. Little subway streetcar thingies to transfer you between terminals at the airport. I like that. That was nice. So I went to Seattle and got my bags. Then I got on the light rail down to Georgetown.
Yeah, and I met you there, and
that's where you live. So
absolutely, I live in the south of downtown Seattle, and well, you got to relax a little bit.
And a bit of a bite of food.
Yeah,
that was a bit odd.
Yeah, it's Halloween bingo at a Western home style restaurant that we went to.
Calamity Jane, right?
Yes, Calamity Jane. And the woman led us to our table, and then another woman came up to us in a Clockwork Orange outfit.
Oh no, it was even worse. We came in, and the first thing we saw was the woman in the Clockwork Orange outfit. Uniform.
Yeah, exactly.
Shoving bingo cards.
Yeah, I think we got bingo cards before we got menus.
We did.
Yeah, so that was interesting, though. We relented, but it turned out to be a hustle. She wanted the first game was free, and then she wanted us to pay. And it was very hard to order because we were playing our free game, and, you know, we could barely read the menu between bingo calls.
Well, you opened the menu again, and there was a number, and you had to...
Yeah.
We didn't win anything either, so yeah. I think she set us up with wrong bingo cards.
Yeah.
Anyway, that was fun. Then we had some sleep.
So you got settled. I mean, what do you think about Georgetown? Or just to see
how fabulous, you know? What
you saw of it?
The whole of Seattle. Wow. Well, I mean, Georgetown, it reminds me of the place where RevSpace is, you know, my own hackerspace where I hail from.
Yeah.
It's an industrial area with some residential in between that's more like falls in between the gaps left by the industrial and there's a whole community striving there and things going on, and it was brilliant. But not far from there, we went into town in Seattle, and it was really Holland-like, actually. I felt at home there.
You think so?
I mean, yeah, the weather was the same, like
was,
shitty and wet and cold,
misty, and
I got wet feet because my shoes leaked, but I got some new shoes, so that was the second thing that made me right, the second thing I indulged in America, like the consumerism.
Yeah,
I got some new shoes, and I felt really good after that.
Yeah, you became a bona fide American consumer.
Yeah. And then we got a crochet needle even. You managed to track down a crochet needle somewhere in some shop, somewhere in an apartment complex.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of yarn, or was it?
Yeah.
Anyway,
what is it?
Yarn? Yarn. I don't know. And, earlier we went to a place you hang out a lot, when you're not traveling, that is.
Absolutely.
The Museum of Communications.
Yeah.
So can you tell a bit about that?
Yeah, the Museum of Communications is a nonprofit run by the Telephone Pioneers of America, and it's independent, but independent of the group, Pioneers group, that is, but it's a project that they've put together, and it basically is two floors in a functional central office. It's the Duwamish Central Office.
Central office. I mean, I first didn't understand. I thought it was some administrative unit, but it's an actual PBX, right? That's switching telephony for the neighborhood.
Yeah, historically in the Bell system, your local exchange would be referred to as central office.
Yeah.
So every part of the state or county has a central office that serves all of the neighborhoods around it, and then those are connected by interoffice lines and so on. It's a way of referring to the phone system. So that's what I meant, and we were able to walk. It's very, very close to where I live in Georgetown, and basically the third and second floors are parts of the museum, and then the first floor is a working office run by Quest Communications, or Quest Telephone, and then they also have internet peering in there. A lot goes on downstairs, but you obviously don't have access to it.
And we had a peek through the door.
Yeah, we looked through the door. We saw some batteries and stuff, and but we were able to go to the third floor where the museum starts, and I volunteer there. It's open on Tuesdays, and basically I help out with a lot of projects, and I learn a lot from some of the older guys.
Yeah, so we met this guy, Troubleman Bob.
Troubleman Bob,
and one of the he worked for the telephone company. A long time.
Yes, for quite a long time.
Yeah.
He's actually one of my favorite guys there, and I tend to follow him around and pick up as much as I can about the older switching systems. It was something I found out on the web, and I found out other people involved with 2600 and some of the other hackerspaces. My friend Chronomex volunteers there when he can. And so that was really nice to have a friend there that also is doing projects and stuff. But we're basically some of the younger guys that volunteer there. And, well, we basically help install demonstrations and even basic things like, you know, setting up a display, building things that support tours. Because basically what they do is they open up on Tuesdays and they're able to turn on power from the batteries on the first floor, and that's donated by Quest. So they get 48 volts to power all of the equipment on the third and the second floor. And the equipment I'm referring to is old switching systems. The Museum of Communications has almost every generation of telephone switch that was put into production. Most of it has been scrapped from central offices as technology changes and things are updated. A lot of this equipment ends up just in a junk pile, or it gets destroyed, or it gets lost. Yeah. And so these guys are very passionate about it. They've been working on the phone system for quite a long time, and their own company doesn't automatically want to preserve this stuff. So they understand the corporate, you know, the corporate element of the company, and they're able to negotiate as an independent nonprofit ways to preserve and keep these things running for educational purposes, so that people know the history. And
the amazing thing is, it all works.
Yeah.
You can walk in there and you hear it clicking. It's all electromechanical mostly. At least I've seen the third floor because we had some coffee and then Bob took us on a tour of the third floor. Where there's massive racks of electromagnetic equipment, and it's nice. You can see it still works, and you start with the older ones. That's the not the elevator thing, but
the panel switch.
The step by step thing.
Oh yeah, the step by step. Yeah, it illustrates it. The step by step is.
It goes up and then it goes sideways to select a number, and
he's able.
He knows exactly how this stuff works. He knows every single lead and every single switch. And he can explain how it works, and then you move on to the more complex stuff, and then you see all the innovation, how the even like simple things as a relay contact, how there has been an evolution, and how those operate, and how those are being assembled and work. And because you get more and more phone connections, so you have a big, it's voice that you have, but you have also a lot of information associated with it. Who are you calling? Which brand's office? What extension number?
How to
build? What line do you use? How to build? Even this surprised. That impressed me actually. That there's a whole diagnostic system in this number 5 crossbar, where you can basically it prints out these trouble report cards, like little punch cards with holes in them, that explain to you if a call failed for some reason. It shows you the whole path in all the relays and what position they were, which lines were used, and well. That was brilliant to see how Bob explained how they used to diagnose these problems. Like they took a couple of these cards and they looked at it, and that's what I liked about it. Bob just knows if he sees this card, he knows where in the schematic of the whole thing he has to look to see what's wrong, you know, and then goes out and tests the relays. It's huge, and it was impressive. And if you're ever in Seattle, I think it's definitely something you should go see. So are they on the internet?
Yeah, museumofcommunications.org, I believe it's org.
That's simple enough, yeah. Yeah. All right. So, that was thanks for taking me there. That was a great experience.
Yeah, I
wonder what's on the third floor.
The second floor, yeah.
I was on the third floor.
Yeah, the second floor has three ESS digital switch. The only working digital switch we have, and a bunch of PBXs, a BT telephone booth, all sorts of old telephones. And there's, I mean, on the third floor, we didn't even really get to look at all the teletypes. It just goes on and on and on and on, all the different equipment involved in communications. So I just felt it was necessary, you know, you had gotten some rest, and it lined up perfectly, because normally on Tuesdays I go there, and I hadn't been in a while, and I said, well, perfect introduction, perfect way to to experience America, go to a museum and learn about the American telephone system first thing in the morning from people who practically built it.
Yep. Well, and one thing is clear, I certainly do have to go there another time, so I'll be back. And, well, what else did we do? We went into town, and then we went to Hackerspace.
Yeah, we enjoyed...
The Black Lodge.
Yeah, we enjoyed the market a little bit, and downtown.
And fish throwing, and that was funny.
Yeah, and as you saw, some of the fish throwing and the consumerism and all of that stuff.
We were really
right downtown, you know, that's basically it, you know, and the market is a really good way to get the flavor of the town. And that evening we went up to Kirkland, which is a little bit east of Seattle.
And over a pontoon bridge.
That's right.
Because apparently the lakes, the chasms.
Correct.
They're too deep to put pillars in, and so you have to make them floating.
That's right. You went across the 520 floating bridge on your way out to Kirkland, and you came back on the I-90 floating bridge.
Which was another, yeah.
Yeah.
So, the Black Lodge, it was interesting. I mean, we didn't arrive at a good time, actually, because they were just evicted from the space. And when we met them there, we drove up to the cabin, the log cabin in the woods. It was kind of pretty, but they were just picking up the last of their belongings. So we didn't get to see much of the space. We talked to the people, really nice people. And we had some dinner at the Olive Garden, nonetheless, which some of you may know from a movie.
The Olive Garden, yes, a true American experience.
Yep. We didn't do any LARPing after that, but we had some great conversation about breadsticks and about the Hackerspace. And they've got a new shop lined up. It's going to be the old one. It was really cozy and homey, and they had a fireplace and everything, and a patio in the woods where they had barbecues. I could see people having fun there. The new one, I understand, is going to be a bit more business-like, a bit more commercial space rented.
Right, with a shop and stuff. Yeah. This felt pretty lived in. You know, I guess they just expanded and they want to take it in a different direction, a little more serious.
I think so.
You know, actually get some benches and some projects going.
They have some regular events. They have a Python programming class and they have some other classes. And yeah.
Well, keeping those schedules is really important, and having events and regular things to attract people. So, you know, it's very, 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 very cool to see. So
That was nice. So the next thing that morning, we had to leave for Portland. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to see the hackerspace that you usually visit, HBL, Hackerbot Labs.
Yeah, Hackerbot's a hackerspace in Seattle that I participate in, and they're only open on Saturdays, unfortunately, so the schedule didn't work out.
Yeah, I arrived on Monday, and we left on Wednesday, so...
Correct, yeah. Well, I guess I could share a little bit about it.
Tell me about it, yeah.
Yeah, since you didn't get a chance. Hackerbot's, it's a private space, and it's only open on Saturday nights. They have a lot of tools and equipment and a private mailing list, and basically people communicate through the list about sort of what kinds of events are going on and what kind of projects they're working on, what they might need help, any kind of news and stuff that's going on. And then when Saturday rolls around, people sort of descend on the space and bring their projects, bring things that they're hacking, trying to, you know, figure out, and basically use the facility, use the tools, use the sitting area to work on maybe some software stuff on their own machine. Or generally just socialize and have fun. And they have a couple projects going that are sort of ongoing, regular sort of activities that have sort of evolved over time, particularly with high voltage and that kind of stuff. And I really had no experience with high voltage when I started working with them and spending time there, and that's one of the reasons it is a private space is because they deal with a lot of things that are relatively dangerous and sort of experimental. They're very, very much into doing things that sort of haven't been done, or just to try things that are, you know, maybe not. They have a little bit of risk in them and that kind of thing. But there's, for instance, a lot of Tesla coils being built there and tested, and we do some.
You've actually worked on Tesla coil.
Well, I've seen them demonstrated. And
something I want to build sometime.
Yeah. I've seen, you know, various demonstrations of them, and that's always a fun attraction for people to see. They have something called a quarter shrinker, which is it's basically something that uses a very short burst of high voltage to shrink quarters, and that's these huge capacitors that send a charge into a box, and it basically makes a loud bang and shrinks these quarters. They've got.
Does it work on tin cans? We need that for our space because we've got too many empty cans.
Yeah, that actually might be a good use for it, although they're hollow, so.
Yes.
Who knows? I don't know. We'll have to try it.
It's worth the experiment.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's not the only hackerspace in Seattle, is it?
No.
I mean, just to get a sense, how big is Seattle? So, how many people do there live in the urban area?
I'm not sure on the exact figure, but it's several million. I think 3 million to 5 million. Okay. I don't. That could be a really, really terrible number, but I'm guessing.
Someone will check it on Wikipedia. Absolutely. And correct us if you're wrong.
That's right. So HBL has its quirks and its advantages, but there's other spaces that are sort of doing other things that I know of. There's other ones that I didn't really know of. I know some of the guys from the Black Lodge, but I had never really been there, and I hadn't worked on very much with them. And, of course, I knew of HBL and started to work with them after tour camp a couple years ago. And they have a lot of tools and equipment there, a lot of science stuff and resources, and it's a lower cost. Once a week, it's a suggested donation of about $15. Students is a little less, and some people pay monthly and that kind of thing.
Okay.
Other spaces are a little bit more retail. There's a space on Broadway in Seattle that's called Metrics that opened up just a little while ago, and they've got different tools. They've got a laser cutter that they do basically any sort of cutting like that could be done on like wood or acrylics and that kind of stuff, and you can go in and use that, and they have basically a cost plan for that kind of stuff. And I think actually you can go and sit at a bench. I don't know if they charge hourly for just using a space, like if sitting down and using your machine at a bench and hacking on maybe a logic board or whatever kind of project you're doing, but it has a more like retail feel.
I think it's more like our concept of the Fab Lab that we have in Europe. It's
absolutely
it's a shop with machines, and you pay for the materials and the time you use,
and
there's a lot of dynamics going on there. But it's
because
people are there working on projects and
they see each
other projects. But hackerspaces are in that sense, I think, more social. It's got this social dimension. You are there to meet people and to work on projects with.
Absolutely.
Well, at the Fab Lab or the tech shop, the Metrics.
Yeah.
There's a couple. I think there was one in Silicon Valley as well. And there's a couple of more that I've seen discussed on the Hackerspace mailing list. You go there to do your own project. Maybe it's even a business project or. So there's quite a lot of places in Seattle.
There's a couple more I just could mention off the top of my head. So Metrics is expanding. They're actually going to get a little bit bigger, and they might change their format a little bit. But there's also Jigsaw Renaissance, which was a hacker from HBL that sort of started her own place. And I'm not even familiar with what they do. I haven't been there yet. But that's kind of how it's branched off, is people, they're members of one space, and they sort of float off and they create their own space based on their interests and what they're trying to accomplish. So they're very specialized, if you can imagine, you know, based on tools, based on the kinds of interests. Another one is Hazard Factory, which deals with a lot of like fabricating and metal and fire and that kind of thing. Where HBL has a little bit of that, their roots are in robotics, so there's a lot of milling and you know, creating enclosures and metal cases and stuff like that. Yeah. But Hazard Factory has more of a spectacle element, like an artistic element. Okay. They're very famous for the power tool drag races in Georgetown, which is an event. You basically have a track and you race. I don't want to call them automobiles. You race vehicles that are made out of power tools down a small track for prizes and all of that. They also are famous for what I hear is flaming tetherball, where you play tetherball. It's like a ball that's on a pole.
Oh, right. And the thing we know from America's Funniest Home Videos that people get in the face, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this one is lit on fire. I've never seen it, but...
Oh, that makes for some funny movies.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So,
I'm
sorry to cut you off.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, I love chatting to you, but we only have an hour today, so...
Oh, geez, okay.
Yeah, we're left Seattle behind us. We went to Portland.
Yeah,
which
yeah.
Which is a bit south to Seattle.
Yeah.
Is it still in Washington State?
No. Portland is in the state of Oregon.
Oregon.
Correct. All right.
I loved driving over to Portland. We drove through the mountains. Green and I liked that part of it. It was my first bit of the states I really got to see, and it was a nice introduction. But so we went to Portland. We went to. Well, basically, we went straight to the hackerspace, Brain Silo, which was in an old industrial building. I think it had grain silos that went from the floor to the well. It went through all the four floors. So
yeah,
they gave me a tour. One of the guys gave me a tour of the. They are on the ground floor.
Right.
They have a really raw area there. But I'll get to that later. So I got a tour of the building. We went up to the the first floor actually is in. A rave club, so it's a bar, and actually I don't know if you're supposed to say it, but it's a bit of an illegal rave thing going on, but anyway, that was closed, so we went to the second floor, which is a huge open space. I think you even took some photography there.
Yeah, sort of an old industrial room.
Yeah, stripped of all the equipment. And
it's very cool, very very cool.
And supposedly we didn't go there, we only went there at night. It's rented out to photographers often because the lighting during the day is apparently really artistic. And but anyway, the third floor, because we went up to the roof, that was our goal. That was on top of the fourth floor. The third floor, we had to navigate an old rickety floor. There were some floorboards here and there and some wet spots. And he showed me exactly where I had to put my feet, because if I didn't, I might fall through the floor and into one of these silos, which would not be altogether enjoyable experience, I think. But anyway, we reached the roof. We had a really nice view of Portland. I took some snapshots. Went down again to the space. It's really raw, raw concrete on the floor. But we looked at the desks, how they were studded, and there were some the pieces of wood to make it all level and. And there was a pinball game there, that was cool.
It was a very young space.
It was
our first visit on the road, and boy, that was one end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
You know, very young, very just getting on their feet.
That just started this January.
Absolutely, yeah. Mere months ago. They're just getting sort of their workspaces set up and projects laid out, that kind of thing. And it was a bit cluttered. There was some, you know, lots of soda everywhere.
Yeah, soda cans and the tools were all over the place. And
things sort of dropped off, but not yet like arranged and set up, you know, the way they're ultimately going to be. It was, you know, very inspiring, but, you know, they've got a lot of work to do. And, you know, they seem enthusiastic and like
that. It's fun, yeah. So yeah. One of the guys, Loki, who was at the roots of the space, he was already soldering on his RFID reader so they could
Correct.
Yeah, could have some access control, give RFID cards to people.
Yeah.
So that's something every space, I think, has to go through when they open. I know MySpace is still struggling with that, and HBL as well, right?
Yeah, so HBL's been doing that for years now, I hear.
And the pinball game, so the first question was, do you know how to fix pinball games? Well, yes, so I dove right into that. I got it working somewhat, and then left the rest to them as an exercise. And there was this guy, Trenton, he was working, he's one of the developers of the Damn Vulnerable web app. And I had a short talk with Trenton about this. I think we should just listen to that.
DVWA is a project that attempts to show all the different kinds of vulnerable code that you could find on the web. And so there's a bunch of different web vulnerabilities in DVWA that gives people the chance to practice without actually getting themselves in too much trouble.
I got a CD with the Damn Vulnerable web app on it. Is it also, if people are interested, where can they check it out?
Yeah, really all you need for DVWA is a web server with some type of SQL. MySQL is what we have done most of the work off of. And you can just put that on any PC. It's downloadable at dvwa.co.uk. There's also a live CD if you want to use it for demonstrations, if you want to put up your own server so that a bunch of people can connect to it. There's a boot CD, so you don't have to worry about them compromising your own host. Although, don't ever use it on a live system because it is vulnerable.
Yeah. And you never know what other vulnerabilities are in there that you guys didn't actually put in there, of course.
Yeah. Well, you have to look around and see what you can find.
Most of it is, I guess, pretty obvious for you and me. If you think a bit about security of web applications, but actually you see these a lot in the wild. If people that are not doing security, they make these mistakes in reality. And is that sort of motivation behind this?
Yeah, I think, and actually, I'm one of the newer developers. Ryan Dewar's Ethical Hacker started the project a few years ago, and I got into it maybe 6 or 7 months ago. But the whole idea behind DVWA is that when people are learning to code, one of the things we'd hope is that they would learn to code securely. And so a lot of these problems are really easy to fix if you know that they exist. It doesn't take much to fix a lot of these, but people will use poor coding because they don't know that the problems are actually there. And so when teaching people to program, you teach them what hackers and what people are going to be looking for. Hopefully, you know, next generation of programmers will be coding more securely. So we right now have a server set up with DVWA, and I guess we can play on with trying to exploit the website.
Yeah, sure, let's see. So it's got a couple of different items here. So it starts with the basics, I guess.
Yeah.
Which is the brute force.
Mm-hmm. So the first vulnerability is just a brute force password attack, and it's just a simple username and password filled, and you can just play on with actually guessing some. The other option is you can try to make it work with automated tools like Hydra to run a script to guess hundreds of usernames and passwords. Just hit it as hard as you can and see what you can find. From that, you should be able to pull out a few usernames and passwords at least.
Okay.
So that's the first vulnerability. And that's a really basic one. It can be a secure system, but if you allow people to make a bunch of guesses, then eventually they could figure things out if people have bad passwords.
So the next one is command execution. I see there's a box here. I can enter an IP address.
Yeah, there's a ping for free application in which you can type in an IP, and when you click on submit, you get a what appears to be
just the raw output of the ping command on Unix. So that suggests that I can just put a semicolon there and, you know, just list files and execute commands.
Yep.
And it's surprising. I mean, you would think no one would make the mistake of just putting user input into an exec or a system. But it happens surprisingly often, though.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and oftentimes people will hide it in the codes in a hidden field or something like that, to where you won't think that they will have access to it. But if there's a potential that user can have input, they oftentimes will have input, and they'll make it do whatever they want to. Yeah, so that's an easy one that you can fix, but happens more often than it should.
Yeah. Oh, here's another classic.
SQL injection?
The problem with SQL injection, one of the problems at least, is that people think that it's limited to web forms and places where you type in input, but there's a lot of interesting places. Barcodes, I know Iron Geek and a bunch of the other people have done a lot of research with barcode SQL injection, where you just scan a barcode that's got one built in and it can crash systems and take over things. So yeah, you find it everywhere, and it's a good one to learn because it's on the web and it's easy to find and it's easy to take over systems with. SQL injection, that just gives you a form to type in user IDs and you can see what you can get. And with this, you can actually get root on the box too. You can create your own forms and then run system commands. And
you can set the Ansible web up to three levels of security.
Yeah.
And you can actually also set it to high, and then you can, it's like an example of how to do it the right way.
Yeah. Okay. High, it's supposed to be unbreakable. It's supposed to be the correct way of doing things. So that's more like the code should be secure. Their application could still have a problem if it's out of date. But the code should be the right way. But the medium is like close. So it like really limits you to what you can do, but there's still ways you can get around it. And then low is just like the way that as bad as it gets.
And this is all open source, right?
So yeah, it's all open source, completely free.
If they play the game, they can check how they should do the...
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, cool. It's a nice project. Thanks for talking to me, and thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool.
Welcome to Valley Transportation Authority. This is the main menu. Para obtener información en español, oprima el 1. Yung tingwit nyan nu so hai.
Kyle, we just left San Francisco.
Yeah.
We're now driving through the Silicon Valley onto Mountain View. What did you think of San Francisco?
Oh, San Francisco. I've never been there. It's very, very, very interesting. Definitely a downtown, like a business corridor. Transportation system is a bit funny, but there's lots of it. And I get sense, if we knew it a little better, had some more time to adapt, we'd probably feel comfortable with it, but we really did throw ourselves right into it.
Yeah, well, I like the BART, it's like the S-Bahn or the RER, the suburban transport. It was really comfortable, the balls of chairs and the...
I know, the carpet.
There was carpet in the train.
Yes, in the train, the floor had carpet, and we were remarking at how cozy it was.
And then people came in with the bike, but I didn't get the bus system. There's four or five companies, and they all don't tell where the others go, and it's hard to figure out.
Yeah, they're sort of not integrated with one another as well as they could be. And that's a bit of a disappointment and an adjustment as someone who's never been. I can imagine it's as confusing for you, especially coming from places where transportation works relatively fluidly. I know people from Europe often say, yeah, well, it's got its own problems too.
But
this seemed a little bit too complicated, overly complicated.
We walked around the city a bit.
Yeah.
I don't think we picked the right part of town there. It's a little of poverty and
weird
types on the streets and
drugs.
And
yeah, we did get to see a lot of these areas where you don't really expect, you wouldn't see a lot of tourists go down those streets. And yeah, we went down and just sort of observed some of the reality. I sort of like that, but it seemed everywhere that, you know, you see people really struggling, you know, with their shopping carts and, you know, living on the streets. More so than you see in other cities. Where I'm from in Seattle, there's certain parts where you get that, but I felt like it was pretty spread out. Everybody was living on the streets or you know...
That's a difference I see with Europe, or at least the Netherlands.
Yeah.
We have a policy to keep people off the street, you know. Government invests in shelters and just to not have all these people on the street and dying of cold and freezing. And I guess it's different here. If you're out there, you're on your own. And
yeah, there's actual, you know, a industry. I mean, these hotels, these small hotels that sort of all kinds of people go to and stay, you know, nightly. And then, you know, because which, you know, become magnets for, you know, that element of, you know, drugs or, wow, you know,
shady.
Yeah, shady stuff. And so there's that whole, that becomes an industry because there's no government support. And another thing is you get these community centers, halfway houses and shelters, but they're not centralized and they have very little help. Mm-hmm. So they sort of do as best they can, but they become magnets because they're all that there is, and they don't have enough resources to support what they attract. So that was a bit
depressing.
Yeah,
it was good to see. I think I'm here to see all of America, not just the shiny beautiful parts.
Yeah, you don't want to you don't want to shelter yourself.
Oh.
But it was. It was pretty eye-opening. I remember one street we walked down, someone was injecting themselves.
Yeah, just was sitting there on the street, right?
Yeah, laying there and injecting her calf with a needle. And that was a bit, you know, it's a bit disturbing. You don't see that out in the open in Seattle, or, you know, I've recently been in Canada and New York City. You don't see that. Maybe I haven't been to the right parts of New York City, but that was a bit interesting.
We then that evening we moved to Noise Bridge.
Yeah.
In San, that's a brilliant place. It's been around for 3 years now, I think, a bit more.
Yeah, they're really doing a lot of different things there, and you get the sense it's very public, and it's got a lot of capacity for people. They had I noticed a cart. An example of this is a cart full of soldering irons. So literally there's like 30 soldering irons, and you know, you could imagine a whole group of people in there building things, maybe all the same thing, you know, get an assembly going on, or all doing their own projects or having a class and stuff like that. And
I like the diversity of it and the size. I mean, there's one corner, you have a hall, you have 3-4 tables, that's a sewing corner.
Yeah.
And the other, you have a room with equipment like a latte and a drill and the welding machine.
Yeah, they definitely.
And you go on, there's a library with I don't know how many books, and you see, it was a quiet night, but it was still, because it was Halloween, everyone was out on parties. And,
yes.
But there was still quite a lot of people about, and you know, some were just sitting and reading and well, we spoke to there's a kitchen area even, which is quite big as well, and so one of the guys there, Frentisek, talk to him a bit, and he's brewing all kinds of nice things, so maybe we can listen to a bit of that.
Yeah, I'd like to. Let's play that.
Yeah. I'm at Noise Bridge. I'm here with Frentisek and Tom, and we're talking about Taste Bridge.
Taste Bridge, okay. So, Proost, this is Kombucha.
Proost. That's nice. What?
It should be a bit more carbonated. It's kombucha, which means, you know, the yeast and bacteria culture, and it's forming the SCOBY, which you have seen from microcellulose.
Mm-hmm.
And traditionally, you make it from black tea, and you make it nice and sweet.
Mm.
You wait when it's cooled down, you know, of course you strain the tea, and you put the kombucha SCOBY in, and it grows where it touches the air. And basically, the advantage of this is that it's probiotic, so if you drink it, you don't have to worry about some other infections, you know, diarrhea, whatever. So this one is a bit different. It's not made from the tea at all. It's made from hibiscus. So that's one of our experiments. This one is honey cooler, which we'll try in a minute or two.
Okay.
This is with the hibiscus and ginger, and it's based on honey. Fermentation of honey by lactobacillus, you know, and other cultures which you have from the yogurt. We use whey for making this. Advantage of this is, you have kombucha, you need a piece of mother to start new culture, at least a bit of liquid. With this, you need just whey and some sugar source, so you can do it basically anywhere in the world, you know.
Okay.
And most of the time, honey and whey you have. So this is kind of, you can come anywhere without anything and you can do it.
You can start doing it.
Yeah, which is great, you know. And this one is the same, but a new batch, which we just, you know, did, you know, we harvested on Wednesday. And I did actually on one workshop, you know, in Underground Market in Oakland.
Oh, okay.
So, because, you know, I was pretty, you know, showing it off, you know, and this one is without any flavor. Meaning no flavoring, like hibiscus, lime, and so on. So this is kind of what we do on brewing classes, which we do have on Wednesdays. So at 6, you know, we come together, I generally speak a bit of, about the theory, you know, and after we move, you know, to the kitchen or lab or whatever, we start to brew. For now, we are non-alcoholic, so we don't produce beers or wine or ciders, but we hopefully will start in 2 or 3 weeks, you know, because there are also people, of course, interested.
Yeah.
And I'm moving out from, you know, kind of the space in within, let's say, next 2 months.
Okay.
So I would like to kind of start something. I know with the technology, it's going to kind of keep the attention up, you know. So I came across Nice Beach, you know, 3 years ago for the first time, 2007, when I was preparing a project in Cuba. And the guys here, they helped me a lot. Not Nice Beach as an entity, because they could be illegal, you know, because of the embargo. But, you know, I got basically donations, you know, from the individual members, so we didn't go against the law.
Yeah.
And I, as a foreigner, can go legally for Cuba.
Okay.
So I did. And okay. I was there for month and a half, you know. It was, they, of course, you know, on the customs, they took all the multimedia center, you know. They kept it for 5 months, you know. But after, actually, at the end, we were able to get it. So it's now working in a University of Matanzas. And
this you ferment it at room temperature, right?
For now it's a room temperature, yeah, which is variable.
Yeah.
And I have realized, actually, because I did, you know, this, you know, for the last 3 years I'm doing things like that. And I've realized that it's actually, you know, I had, you know, aquarium, you know, so the most simple incubator, you know, if you are somewhere, go for the shop with aquariums, get the aquarium heater with thermostat, you know, change it, you know, that you can regulate, how you say it, when you can change it, you know, the temperatures, if you like, and get an insulated ice box. Put it in, a little bit of water, like this, you know, nice, and put your cartridges just in it, you know.
Okay.
Wonderful. However, it just was never so good, you know. And the reasons why it was not so good, I'm, you know, kind of very sure, you know, about it, is because it's just one temperature, you know. And the thing is, you know, if you have there, for example, you know, I was working with kefir grains, which you use for fermentation of milk. Have you seen them? Kefir grains, you know, they are small, they look actually like a piece of brain, you know, cauliflower, you know. They grow, you know, they are whitish because of the milk, you know. And you have around, you have around 30 different organisms in the grains, basically.
Okay.
Quite a lot.
That's, yeah.
And they certainly don't like one temperature, you know. You know, you know, they like many, you know. So, you know, I was kind of thinking, okay, fine, you know, how I can, you know, do it well, you know, and I realized, okay, well, best taste, because there were experiments with industrial, you know, like if you're making loads of problems, and taste not very good, you know, they had to go from 30 to 7 microorganisms, you know, and so on and so on. And I said, well, actually, you can do it, but you would have to be able, you know, basically, you know, oscillate temperatures, you know. And, you know, it took me a while after to realize, you know, kind of that no one really is doing that. You know, we were starting to look for incubators. I realized that, you know, it's even a problem to get incubator, kind of, you know, which would be, you know, having yet just one temperature by incubator, which where you can set, let's say, I don't know, 30 degrees of Celsius, and not to buy expensive laboratory incubator. Or, you know, kind of something really industrial, it's really big problem, you know. So kind of, you know, I was just sitting there, so it's not in your eyes.
Okay.
So, you know, kind of, you know, I went around the idea and realized, okay, it's really untouched. And after that, you know, kind of, I've seen people, you know, already build here a how you get sous vide machine. It's a new way of cooking, or maybe old, I don't know. You basically get, you know, again, a water bath. You get your heater there, let's say you set it on 60 degrees of Celsius, you know. And you put your steak in a, you know, you vacuum seal it or you put it in a zip bag, air out, put it in and let it cook, you know, for example, with sauces and salt, and you let it cook at 60 degrees of Celsius, let's say, for example, for 5-8 hours.
Okay,
and it's done later on.
Yeah. Okay.
Great idea. You know, for many things, excellent. You know, one project, you know, dehydrator, another one, you know, and, you know, I believe that this century is basically a really biotech century. You know, I don't say, you know, it's not computers and electronics, you know, clearly, yes, together, you know, but I mean, basically, it's supposed to be together. Because the last century was of chemistry. Mm-hmm. Chemistry kind of, you know, was really big, you know, concerning production, you know. Of course, electronics, all these things developed, but the way kind of how we work with materials, maybe, you know, I would say it was a lot of chemicals, petrochemical.
it's been quite a quite an interesting journey, and well, I'm just really excited. I think we're starting to see the diversity of the types of spaces, the different types of work that people are doing.
Yes, that's all the diversity of places.
Yeah, and even within the place, like with you know what you were saying with Noisebridge, they had a huge library.
Yeah.
They had you know, a kitchen and all these different things, a shop. Really incredible. Lots of places to sit and relax. And
I think we're getting the hang of it now. It took some getting used to the, well, to each other again and the
traveling
and, well, meeting up with the people and
preparing yourself for the day if we're gonna walk around
and get the routine going.
Yeah.
I think we're getting there now. It's
And you know, we were able to like arrange things and communicate with people. It's really essential using communication and texting people. We're able to set up arrangements and meetings, and you know, for instance, I believe this morning we were communicating with some people, and well, we set up an opportunity to talk with these people. They're not officially in any sort of space at the moment, but they're doing some really interesting things, and we were able to talk with them and learn a little bit more about what they're doing. You want to describe a little bit about?
It's a BioCurious. It's a whole new. I didn't hear about it. Apparently, it's been going on for a while. It's biohacking biology.
Yeah.
Doing biology in your garage, in your hackerspace, anywhere outside of the big labs. So I was looking for that when we got here. People recommended, well, you should talk to these people. They do cool stuff. And well, we hooked up with them. We went to the little Vietnamese place where we ordered some noodles and some coffee. And we sat over dinner and talked to them. What was it called? The Open PCR project.
Correct.
It's like a MakerBot, but it's for doing biological research, DNA sequencing, and well. I think we met up with Tito, and he explained it quite well, so...
You know what Maker Faire is? Awesome. I remember this, like, five-year-old kid came up to me, and we had the side off, and there was, you know, the Arduino in there, and it's like this blue chip that's super recognizable. And the kid, like, the perfect quote was, he pointed at the Arduino, and he's like, oh, I know, that's Arduino, I work with that. And he's like, but what's the rest of it, right? And so it's like the perfect introduction to, well, it's sort of like Arduino, but for biotech. And so it's, you know, it's interesting how different people get excited about OpenPCR. So we've designed it so that we use as many off-the-shelf components as possible. We use like an ATX power supply, just a regular heatsink from a computer from Newegg. Do you know what a Peltier device is? You know what? Okay. Because that's what heats up and cools down the DNA. And some flat aluminum parts. You need the block for the metal is probably, for the tubes, is probably the hardest thing.
Okay.
You can get that fabricated, or, you know, if you want to just get to building it, we have kits on our website, openpcr.org. And, yeah, you can sign up to get a kit, and then you just build it like a MakerBot. Yeah.
DNA is one field of doing experimentation.
Uh-huh.
Is there anything else like bacteria activities or?
If you're, you know what iGEM is, or synthetic biology. If you're, it's about engineering biology to do something cool. So we were working on building a bacteria that would detect lead. Like the metal in a water sample. The engineering isn't there yet. It's still much of a research project. So there's a huge difference between research and engineering. I mean, research... Yeah, I was at Noisebridge last weekend, and we were talking about OpenPCR, and the guys were talking about DNA computing. and doing, I guess, cracking
relatively
like
relatively close. Sorry, what were you gonna say?
24/8-bit keys using E. coli. They're gonna try it, right? I mean,
place
just sort of more of a academic exercise,
right,
I think. But you
right,
know,
in Mountain
like how many
or,
gallons of you know, bacteria would you need
if
each,
we can find
so,
space
you know, the,
near
the problem
Stanford?
Is,
that's
if you take all the computers on Earth.
City over.
It's the,
that would be great too.
Whatever, a million years or infinity to crack this code, right?
The
thing is, I mean, if a computer is the size of a cell, then, I mean, you've got more computers in this bowl of fud than the rest of the world right now. I mean, if you've got, you know, a bowl full of hopefully cells or something. Yeah.
Country Kicks 96.
First class wise of the United States Marine Corps.
God bless you. Thank you so much for your service, Marine. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, man. I was just wondering if you could play a song for me and my girlfriend. I just got back from boot camp on Saturday.
Now, this girlfriend of yours, will she be going with you when you get stationed somewhere else?
Yes, ma'am.
So you going to marry this girl?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. I don't want to put the cart before the horse or anything, but, you know, if you love her, marry her.
Her name's Rachel Ryder.
And when are you going to put a ring on it?
I'm hoping to put a ring on her finger within the next year.
That's great. Good luck. Congratulations, and thank you for your decision to serve. How was Marine boot camp? Was it pretty hard?
It was, but it wasn't nearly as hard as I expected it to be.
Did you bulk up a little bit after you got back? People say you look bigger or skinnier? What?
They said I look more muscular and skinnier at the same time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. They leaned you out. They got to make a Marine out of you, you know?
Yes, ma'am.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life. And I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars.
So, we just left LA. We ended up in a trailer somewhere in the desert to indulge in the full American experience. LA was great, I think.
Yeah, I really enjoyed LA. There was a lot of really friendly people there. And we managed to see all the spaces we had set out to see.
Amazingly.
Yep. And, boy, we have a lot of material, a lot of things to reflect on, which we'll bring to people in the next week or two.
Yeah, because this show is almost over. We're done for today.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it was fun to do. There's a lot of different... but I noticed the biological hacking thing. That's something that's really coming up now. And you see, it's in the same area that the computer revolution started, basically, the Silicon Valley, the San Francisco area.
And I think
they're now all into the...
Yeah. It's becoming really popular and important, and it's very, like, very complicated, and it's in its infancy. And wasn't it funny, we were at Null Space, and they're like, oh, yeah, we have a gene sequencer over
here.
Yeah, yeah. Wasn't that funny?
Was funny. Is it a gene sequencer? Yeah, that's, yeah. They're also doing this stuff, so
Do you have one at your space?
Not yet.
Not yet.
I'm gonna get one. The OpenPCR project is great, and I hope to convince some people at RevSpace to invest in one. So what are we gonna do? We will stay a bit here, a bit longer in the desert, which is kind of lovely. I never saw a desert. Then we'll start a trip in the direction of Chicago. We'll go to Salt Lake City, Denver, and some other places in between. So more on that next week. And thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Well, there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say.
There ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
listening to the High Desert's Hot Country, 96.3 FM, KXCM. That's how we spell kicks. Kicks 96. 96.